Jamie's shit.
Jamie's
bad. Jamie's did something wrong.
Okay.
It's the name for the secondary offenses. The secondary that offenses against your bodhisattva vows. You finished how many root vows?
18.
18, and now we're going to do 46 and 18. Now you know the main difference between a Nietzsche and a Tsatsun. What is it? A Nietzsche and a root downfall. What's the difference between these 46 and the other 18? What's that? Yeah, that's the basic, that's the bottom line. If you do a Tsatsun, it destroys your vows. You lose your vows. You have to take them over. If you do a Nietzsche, you can restore them.
Michael, can you talk a little bit about the characteristic of that one with that group of three or more?
They have to. One thing in a confession always is they have to understand the gravity of what you're saying, and they have to take it seriously. If there's someone who doesn't take their vows seriously, then it's not good to confess in front of them. It has to be somebody who understands how seriously.
So they have to be Buddhists.
And yeah, it's normally in this kind of thing, it's for them to understand what you're. You can't confess something that the other person doesn't even know what it means to break it. Normally. But I'll look more carefully and see if there's anything else.
Stealing is commonly perceived as a bad deed, so...
What's that?
You don't have to be Buddhist to understand it.
Oh, yeah. But you're confessing breaking a vow and not just committing a bad deed. And it's much more serious.
I wanted to ask you, what is it about the process of confession that they care to do?
He says, what is it about the process of telling somebody that restores them? It's mainly the fact that you have the four forces in your mind in order to want to tell somebody. So if you didn't have those four forces in your mind and you just told somebody, I think the main point is that telling someone indicates that you have the four forces. You're sorry you did it. You know, you're trying to make up for it. By telling someone, you're almost necessarily implying that you intend not to do it again. So I think it's all those, it's really the four forces that repair it. And I think anytime you do an honest chakra, opening up your heart to somebody and telling them what you did, admitting what you did, then it's almost assumed that you have the four. The four definitely remove the karma. Okay. Tonight we gotta truck along. I'll stay till midnight, but I don't think you will. Koincho means what? You know, Koincho Sun. It's the three jewels. Three jewels. Who are the three jewels? Same as Buddha Dhamma Sangha. Okay? The jewel of Buddha, the jewel of Dharma, the jewel of Sangha is not the same as the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. Okay? But we'll get into it. Koincho Sun La means to them. Sun means three. Mi chu means not to offer. I personally used to mix this one up with another kind of vow that some of you might know. And don't mix it up, okay? Not that one. But Koincho Sumla Sumi Chu means failing to offer the three to the three jewels. Failing to offer the three to the three jewels. Okay, and now I'll explain what the three are. Three here means to make offering in your body, speech, and mind. Doesn't mean to make offering three times a day, for example. It means to make some kind of offering in your body, speech, and mind. Yeah, and I'll tell you some examples. Jetsun Kapa says, at minimum, you know, you have to make some kind of prostration or do anything, you know, something physical. Bow to the altar, do some kind of physical. Within a 24-hour period, you must do something once. Bow to the statue of the Buddha, just do any kind of reverence to it physically. But that's its first part. Verbally means say any kind of minimum four lines about the three jewels, you know, about the Buddha. Like when you do an offering, you're supposed to offer everything you eat or drink. There's an offering in your notebook. At minimum, you're supposed to say something nice about me right now. They know the best thing to teach you right now. That's their quality. So you just think of them. And then the text says you can also bow to an image. So you're either bowing down to the real Buddha, which is what I just talked about, or you can bow down to the image, and it's enough.
If you don't have an image, would you imagine the image?
Yeah, no, they're saying that. So that's body speech. Say something good about, Dharma, what is Dharma? Gok Lam. Gok Lam, this is the true Dharma. True Dharma is Gok and Lam. Gok means permanently stopping any bad qualities within you. The permanent, it's what they call cessations, and I hate that word, because, you know, do we use it in normal English? I don't know. It's the cessation of bombing of Serbia. Bosnia. Okay, yeah. Cessation means stopping. But in Buddhism, cessation means a permanent state that you reach, that you will never again have one kind of bad thought. For example, you can reach, when you see the emptiness directly, you reach two cessations. What, do you remember what they were?
No.
You only get rid of two mental afflictions permanently at that point. One is doubt about Buddhism. Why?
Because you see Buddhas.
You saw Buddhas. You saw your past life. You saw your future life. You know how many future lives. You saw the day that you were going to become enlightened. You know what they're going to call you and what they're not going to call you. You know. You see the Buddha directly. You see his Dharmakaya. So, and you see your past life. So who's going to talk you out of it after that? What do you care what anyone says after that? You know. Anybody can come with any half-baked New Age philosophy to you, and you just laugh. You just say, you know, it's not right. I saw it. What are you going to tell me? And then what's the second one?
Intellectual
belief in self-existence, which means you realize that every perception you ever had was infected with seeing things as self-existent. And you realize that after you come down out of seeing emptiness directly, that's going to reassert itself in your eyeballs, okay, and in your mind. In other words, again, you're going to see everything as self-existent, but there's one big difference between before and after. You know you're wrong. There's little comfort, but at least you know you're screwed up. You know that your perceptions are wrong. So that's at least some advantage, some advance. Then the whole journey to nirvana and the whole journey to Buddhahood is removing that tendency. Taking all that time to remove that tendency. So that those are two mental afflictions that you achieve a gopa. Gopa means it'll never come in your mind again. Doubt about Buddhism and
true doubt about Buddhism.
I'm getting to that. Doubt about Buddhism and intellectual belief that things are the way they look. So at that moment you achieve two gopas. There are many, there are thousands of gopas. I just gave you two examples. That is the real Dharma. When you go for refuge, when you pray to the Dharma, to the Three Jewels, when you think about the Three Jewels, when you read books about the Three Jewels, that's what they're talking about. And that's one of the most important gopas, those two. So what are you praying to? It's not a person. You're praying to a condition. It's very interesting. That's the real protection. Who else could protect you but your gopas?
You're saying all of
them. Not like some being is up there, here, I'm a refuge, come protect, I'll protect you.
You're saying all the gopas are what you go to refuge?
Yeah.
Or the Dharma?
Half of the Dharma. The other half is Lam. Lam means what?
Path.
True path, meaning one of the great realizations of Buddhism. For example, perceiving emptiness directly. That's a Lam. So when you pray in Buddhism, like if you go to the temple and you sit down and you're making prostrations, you are making prostrations to the perception of emptiness directly. You're making prostrations to the condition of getting rid of your anger forever or your jealousy forever. It's very interesting. You're not going for refuge to a person when you go to the Dharma Duel. You're throwing yourself at the feet of those perceptions and those cessations. It's very beautiful. It's very interesting. That's the only thing that can really protect you. Wait, is some person going to put his hands on you and keep you from getting old? But those two things can. Perceiving emptiness directly can keep you from getting old. Can really protect you. So that's the Dharma Jewel. Sangha Jewel is very simple. Yeah.
So, the two Dharma you said, the Gopa and
the Dharma Jewel.
The two Dharma Jewels.
Good.
Gopa and the
Lama. Yeah.
Okay, so So I've got Gopa, that's truly getting that position.
Yeah.
And then
it's the condition of that.
But I got a little lost when you said
Lam,
frustration.
Lam and Dopa are synonyms in Buddhism. Dopa means a realization, a spiritual realization, a level of spiritual realization. For example, when you finally reach renunciation about this life, you've achieved Lam. That is Lam. Lam is not the path in general. It's those specific ideas in your own mind. That's Lam within your own mind. Here, Lam does not refer to that whole process or those whole things. You are prostrating to those ideas. You're prostrating to those realizations as other people have them, or as you may have them sometimes. You will have them sometimes. And that's taking refuge. It's very interesting.
Is that the same cessation?
No, not at all. Cessation is like space. It's the simple absence of a thing. And Lam is a changing consciousness. It is your consciousness. It's a mental function. One is a living, changing thing. One is a simple absence of something, like an empty room. It's very interesting. One never changes, the other one changes all the time. And always will. That's what you're supposed to make offerings to at least once every 24 hours. Who is Sangha? Nominal Sangha is the people who are ordained. But the real Sangha is, you can guess.
People have seen emptiness. People who have realized true emptiness.
No, you got it, but a little bit more.
You've seen direct emptiness.
Okay, okay. Big difference. I mean, zillions times different is the Buddha, is the Dharma jewel, Sangha jewel. Anyone who has seen emptiness directly automatically becomes the Sangha jewel. So really, when you the day that you perceive emptiness directly, you become two of the three Ratnas. What are they? I mean, it's just, you become the Sangha, and you have the Dharma Ratna. So it's interesting. People are taking refuge to you. It's very interesting. It's a weird idea to think of.
But then at that point, you're no longer you.
No, you're very much you. But you're an Arya. You've seen emptiness. You become the refuge for the world. Yeah.
What good does that do,
taking refuge in the way you see? Taking refuge means, it means putting all your hopes in this life in that object. You know, we had it out in California. It's very interesting. We had all these lectures about emptiness, seeing emptiness directly. Five people came up after the sit. If I came to New York City, and, you know, I'm a certain age now, if I gave up my house, my family, my kids, if I came there, could I learn to see emptiness directly within like 6 weeks or a year or 2 years? They said, what means is, at that moment they took refuge. They had real refuge. That was real refuge. Very interesting. I mean, real refuge was generated in their mind. I'll give up everything if I could see emptiness directly in this life. There's some way that you could say, okay, you know, come to New York, in 6 months you see emptiness directly. That was the act of taking refuge. Those people got refuge. It was very nice.
You can meet them at Fridays.
Oh, very possible. Very possible. That's the whole idea. But it takes a lot of work on your side. Like, if you have to meditate an hour a day, period. You must meditate an hour a day. You cannot see emptiness without meditating an hour a day. Impossible. So if you won't give 15 minutes, you've just disqualified yourself. You will never see emptiness.
An hour a day takes years, though, right?
No, I don't mean pure concentration for an hour a day. I mean sitting down for at least 1 hour a day to practice getting into a deep state of meditation. And if you don't do that, you've disqualified yourself. You will suffer more. Your suffering doesn't have a limit. You know, the Buddha can't come and say, your suffering now has this limit. Because if you disqualify yourself from seeing emptiness directly, the Buddha has to say, I can't tell. I don't know. When you're gonna stop your suffering, I can't say. Yeah. One more question. We didn't get past the second.
Yeah, Michael, I just want to ask, if you meditate, you can also get
It's not seeing emptiness. We'll get there. If I don't get there by the end of the secondary vows, let me know. Okay? There are vows that relate to that. There are vows in the Bodhisattva vows. We'll get there. No. But you'll learn. You have to have some more classroom hours. And then you'll know the answer. But it's important to know. If I don't cover it by the end of the 46 vows, ask me again. Okay. So you must make offerings to them in those three modes at least once in every 24 hours. And those are the real things you're offering to. I think it's much easier to offer to those things because it makes sense. You know, it just makes sense. You know, who cares if you put a banana in front of a Buddha image? You know, but if you truly in your mind are tuned into, if when you take refuge or when you make an offering, it's really remembering the essence of that realization, that's true. That's something that's going to really change your future. It's an important act as a Buddhist. Also, when you achieve the path of seeing, when you see emptiness directly, you will gain a new appreciation for Buddha images. Because they really do represent an enlightened being that you met. So when you see one, you're kind of affectionate towards it. I mean, they take on a whole different meaning. They're not just little plaster things there on the table anymore. They represent the Godhead that you met. And they're very important after that. 12:30 if you want.
What good is it to put banana for an hour?
No, it's mainly the act of remembering the Arya's qualities.
Alright.
It's not that the Arya can come and, you know, Franny.
It's showing what you aspire to, right?
There is a blessing. There is a blessing by an ignorant person putting a banana on an altar. There's a great blessing. But the blessing of understanding what the Arya is while you give it, while you offer the banana, is fantastically effective. And so you have to do it every day. Okay. It's not on your homework, okay? But these are coming, they're not in a standard group text. These are coming from Chandra Gomi's 20 verses on morality. He wrote a book named 20 verses on morality. And these are coming from them. There, if you want to memorize something to keep your vows with, this is what people usually use.
Everybody's so tired. I'm tired. We'll just all be tired.
Dipne sem means thoughts of desire. Thoughts of desire. Thoughts of something you'd like to own. Lustful thoughts. Thoughts of that you'd like to eat something. I mean, thoughts of any kind of improper thought of desire.
Improper.
Dipne sem ki. Jason Juk means to let it go on. Okay, so the second secondary vow is to allow thoughts of desire to go on.
But it's improper.
We'll get there. He gives three examples. He says, Jason Kapa says, dupachewa, which means excessive desire for something, you know, like sensual desires. And then secondly, he says, chokmishepa, which means a state of mind in which you never allow yourself to be satisfied with what you have. And the third one is an attachment to other people's honor, like especially if you're teaching or something. Get attached to having other people pay respect to you and say what a nice guy you are, offer you things. The second one was the human tendency never to be satisfied with what you have. Is it wrong to have those thoughts? No. I mean, it is, but it's not breaking a bodhisattva vow. If you let it go on without fighting it, you break a bodhisattva vow. So Jesu Juk means just to ride along with the thought of desire and not struggle against it, not try to stop it. Okay. If you, Jetson Kapa says, and he says it very clearly, and he says it for several other vows, if that thought is starting to control your mind, you have some desire, say a sexual desire, and it's getting stronger and stronger, and you're going to do something wrong, like a monk, for example. And it's getting stronger and stronger, and if you just ride along with it and let it go, and let it take over your mind, you've broken this vow. If you put up any kind of fight, you don't break the vow, even if it overwhelms you. You know, even if it leads you to commit a bad deed. He says, that bad deed that you do is very bad, and you commit a very bad karma. But you don't break your bodhisattva vow. Because the bodhisattva vow is to put up a good fight. Even put up any kind of fight. Okay? And if you're a person who's been trying to be a good Buddhist, you know what this means. I mean, there's times when you get angry or you get desire, and anger is going to come later. But you have a desire for something, you know it's not right. At least you're fighting it. As long as you're fighting it, you don't break your bodhisattva vow. If you put up the wimpiest kind of fight, you don't break your bodhisattva vow.
When you say you have a desire for something that's not right, what about like just chocolate cake as an example, you know?
I think the te, okay, you want to know the te. Te means at what point does it become not right?
Yeah.
When you would do something wrong to get it.
Wrong meaning one, but violating
any
morality
of the
bounties, or
yeah.
something like that.
Simple enjoyment, as long as it doesn't create any kind of mental affliction. Dalai Lama enjoys chocolate cake, I'll guarantee you. Rinpoche likes it when the Mets win. You know what I mean? It doesn't mean you have to avoid all pleasures. No. It means avoid any destructive pleasures.
It'd be like taking like a big share of it and not sharing it type of thing.
Yeah, stuff like that. Any kind of...
What was the third?
The third example he gave, Jesakapa, was attachment to gain or fame. By the way, just so you know, the structure here is that we're going through the six perfections. All of these so far have been against the perfection of giving, the first perfection. All this first group that we're going to do are things that ruin your practice of the perfection of giving. Say Gemba. Gemba means elders. Gemba Nam means elders. Gumiche means not respecting. Oh, I skipped one. No, I didn't. Oh, okay. No, I didn't. Here, Gemba doesn't mean elders in general. It means elder in the sense of vows. For example, when you become a monk, one of the most important parts of the ritual is that someone has to mark the time. When the vows are given by the abbot and he goes, ding, somebody has to look at the clock real fast and write it down. I took my vows at 7:52, on this date. Why? Why is it such a big deal? What it means is around the world, at that moment, anyone who takes their vow 1 minute later has to respect me. In the monk's code, he can be 90 years old. But if he took his vows 1 minute after I did, I'm senior. So when there's an assembly, I sit in front of him. If there's a food distribution, I get mine first. These are all monk's rules. It's the same among bodhisattvas. This elder refers to someone who took their vows before you. It's someone who is elder to you in the sense that they've had their bodhisattva vows longer. What does respect mean? I mean, if you're making tea, you offer them the first tea. If they walk in the room, stand up. It's almost like what we used to do for women in the West, I think. You know what I mean? We used to wait till they started to eat before we ate. We used to open the door for them. We used to stand up. Things like that. That was sort of the kind of behavior. It's just to show respect for that person. They're older than you in that sense. And that's a bodhisattva topic. Shubhani.
Lend me debt.
Jiva means a question. Lend me debt means not answering. Okay. Failing to answer a question. You break this when you either don't give an answer to a sincere question, or when you give an irrelevant answer to a sincere question. Either way. So even if you give an answer, it's not enough. It has to be a serious answer. It has to be some kind of answer to that tells them what they're asking. Yeah. Any question, not just dumb questions.
So if somebody asks you directions...
What it means is this is kind of a diss of other people.
you know, and I do it all the time, you know, and it's kind of showing that you're superior or something, you know. They're asking you a question, and you just joke around, or you never answer it clearly, or you don't even turn to them and address their question. It's just it's a diss of sentient beings. And as a bodhisattva, you're not allowed to do it anymore. You know, you have to pay attention to other sentient beings. When they ask you a question, you have to answer it. And it's very interesting. I mean, I did it. Now I have to answer all my voicemail and everything.
Let's say somebody asked a very serious question about tantra or secret teaching.
I'll give you. Now I'm going to tell you. I'm going to teach you something called Yeme. Say Yeme.
Yeme.
Yeme stands for Nyeche, which means what? We got about a 12-minute retention tonight.
No, I didn't hear it the first time.
Yeah, is Nyeche, yeah. Bad deed.
Name is bad?
Breaking a secondary balance. Name means not. So what's a Nyeme? Nyeme means no problem. You did not break the vow. Nyemes are lists of exceptions. The Vinaya is full of them. Mix-ups, they call it in the Vinaya, mix-ups. Like, I can wear my hair. I'm not supposed to wear my hair longer than that. If there's a purpose, and if my abbot tells me to, I have to wear my hair longer than that. So that's a mix-up, that's a Nyeme. I do not break my monk's vow. If I'm under that instruction to do that. So, I'll give you a list of Nyemes for these last two, which are, oh boy, not answering a question, and not respecting your Bodhisattva elders. He says both of them are okay if you're sick and you just can't get up. He says you don't break answering a question if you're asleep and you're like groggy and it's not quite clear in your mind whether they ask a question or not. And you can extend these to other circumstances. And it's important to know because it's good to know when you've broken a vow and when you haven't broken a vow. It's very important in Buddhism to know when you've broken a vow and when you haven't broken a vow. He says certain situations, like if I'm teaching Dharma, and it would be interrupting the flow of things for me to talk to someone who's asking me a personal question. So I don't break my vow. If I say, well, later, or, you know, I'll talk about it later. You don't break it if you're listening to a Dharma talk and someone asks you a question and you know it would distract you. And that happens a lot in Dharma talks. Someone's trying to ask you a question that's not related, you know, like, what movie are you going to see tomorrow? And and you say, no, I'm trying to listen, and you don't answer. That's okay. Yeme. He says, if getting up or showing respect for that person would disrupt a Dharma teaching, you don't have to do it. You know, it's like in a monastery, all sitting like that. There's 1,000 monks crushed into a temple, and if you stood up, you'd step on people, and it would interrupt the teaching, and the person might be upset his teaching. And lastly, very carefully, there's a special bodhisattva, Nyeme, that covers almost all the Nyeches. And this Nyeme is if you want to teach the person a valuable lesson. But you have to be very sure of yourself. You can fool yourself, and you know that. Okay? You can really fool yourself. It means if you're aware that that person has a problem with being too proud, and you're aware that if you diss them, okay, if you didn't stand up, they might reflect about their pride and maybe it would help them lead them away from pride, then it's a nyeme if you don't get up and if you don't show them respect. But be very careful. Make sure it's not just your own pride or your own, you don't feel like it. Yeah.
And if you're angry at them for before and they're trying to be good, then you're breaking one of the primary vows.
Yeah. Also, the reasons you break these vows can be two, and that's on your homework, okay? One is called afflicted and one is called non-afflicted. In other words, in one case you have an active bad thought, and in the other case you don't have an active bad thought. In either case you break it, okay? In either case you break your vow. An example of breaking your vow with a bad thought would be if you were angry and you didn't want to respond to the person. To the person's question. And an example of, in general, okay, and they're special, they shift around, but in general, if you just forget, you still break the vow, but it's non-afflicted, okay? You don't have a bad thought in your mind, but you still break the vow. It's not as bad, but you still break the vow. If you just forget, or if you're too lazy, you don't feel like getting up, That's not like anger. It's not like we would consider a heavy mental affliction in this case. But it's, you do break your vow. You just don't feel like getting up. You're not sick or anything else.
Being lazy be much worse than forgetting?
He doesn't distinguish. I mean, he puts them both on the same level of less bad than anger. He grades them about the same.
He's restoring something, not
a... I probably is a little bit. I don't believe within the ages. It is more serious.
One thing is intent.
Yeah. I think in restoring it, there would be a difference. One would be easier, right?
Would the last one also be? Would the last one also abuse
practice? Yeah. Jumbo.
Jumbo.
Dagger.
Dagger.
Jumbo.
Jumbo.
Dagger.
Dagger.
Jumbo means guest. Dagger Mijay means not to agree to be. And what it means is not to accept a sincere invitation.
Just dharma or other than
that? We'll talk about it.
Now, the sirocco that comes
back. No, it could be anything. I mean, it could be... What it means is if someone invites you to their home, or monks invite you to a monastery, or anything, if they ask you to come to dinner or things like that, a bodhisattva has to agree.
That's assuming they're virtuous, though.
We'll talk about the nyemes, okay? You ready for nyemes?
Yeah.
Okay. By the way, it has to be out of pride or anger. It has to be out of some kind of...
Oh, okay.
Or laziness, in some. Okay? Or not feeling like it.
You mean for it to be a violation?
It's a violation whether your mind is afflicted or whether it's just lazy. It's still a violation.
Well, this is...
Now he gives the nyemes. The nyemes are the following. If you're sick, you don't have to go. Sorry, everybody will get a headache, right? If you've already accepted another invitation. If it's too far to go and it would be difficult for you to go, very difficult, or somehow dangerous to go, like 39th Street. Or if you're aware that the person who's inviting you has been inviting you for some kind of bad motive, like they want to hurt you when you get there or something. Like if you're aware that they don't have a very pure motive for asking you, you don't have to go. Or, in very, very extreme cases, where you're a very, very wise bodhisattva, you can refuse them in order to teach them a lesson. Somehow divert them to virtue from non-virtue by refusing to go. That somehow they would get some inkling in their mind, oh, why don't they want to come? Well, maybe I've been doing something wrong. You know, that they would somehow be pushed a little closer to goodness if you dissed them. So then you're allowed to not accept an invitation.
You have to know that that's the...
You have to really be... You'll see later today. I think it comes tonight. You really have to be highly qualified to make those distinctions. I think it's true most of the time that people overrate their qualifications.
Well, that obviously could be very dangerous. But if someone motivates you with well intentions, but they have vices and stuff, but you should stay away from them.
Yeah, I mean, if you're aware that there's going to be pot smoke there, you don't have to go. It's a bad motivation.
Mm-hmm.
It's also, you know, people get arrested,
but
you know.
If you don't like the person, I mean, you're really not.
If they're sincere, you have to go. That's part of being a bodhisattva. Bodhisattva is not, it's obviously not like the, It's not like the monk's vows. Bodhisattva vows, you can smell now. They're different. It's reaching out to people. It's embracing people. You know, you have to. That's different from the monk's vows. Bodhisattva vows are very much... they're your children now. And you can't put down your children. Your child is asking you something. You have to supply it. That's bodhisattva.
If you had a dharma commitment of practice and it conflicted, would you be able to go that and exempt the dharma?
No problem. No problem. Well, by the way, he does say that if it would divert you from some virtue that you're engaged in, you know, if you're engaged in an important virtuous act and it would divert you or interrupt that, you don't have to go.
Staying dinner with your wife.
Sarah?
Sarah.
La sopa?
La sopa.
Lenmiche.
Lenmiche.
Sarah means gold. La sopa means etc. Lenmiche means not to accept it. ACC. Okay? Not to take it if someone offers it to you. It means money and things. Okay? If someone comes to you and sincerely offers you something, as a bodhisattva, you must graciously accept it. This especially relates to monks like in India. We were not allowed to touch money. We're not allowed to sell ourselves on lemmiche. We're not allowed to own money. We're not allowed to touch it. But if someone comes to you with a very sincerely and offers you some money or something or something like that, as a bodhisattva, to make them feel right, you have to accept. There's a lot of nyemes here, okay? Now I'll go over them.
That's literally currency, or is it any kind of good?
Meaning, he says, yoje kanshi, it means anything of value.
So it's like not to accept other gift or an offer.
Right. Here's all the nyemes. They're kind of cute, okay? If you know, you get attached to the thing after you took it. All right? If you know that you would get attached to it. After, like, if somebody gives me some certain kind of music, okay. if you're pretty sure that the person who gives it to you would later regret it, because that's a very bad deed for them. It's a particular kind of bad deed to in a fit of generosity to give something, and then they regret it for 6 months. You know, it's a special kind of bad deed in Buddhism. Okay. If you believe the person, I've seen it happen with lamas. I've seen people offer houses to lamas, and they took it, you know. And then 2 weeks later, the person's like, "Oh my God, you know, I don't have a place to stay." And the lady was living in her car, and you know, and she regretted it for months. And the lama shouldn't have taken it. The lady shouldn't have given it. You know, it was just shouldn't take it if the person's going to change later. And you know pretty well that they're going to change later.
Would the lama know?
Well, I mean, you have to judge the situation. In general, we've seen, like with teaching emptiness, as long as you make your best judgment, even if you're wrong, on the basis of that, I say it's not bad. But you have to make an attempt to judge whether or not the person might go back on their generosity later, and then don't let them do it. Okay. If you think it might not belong to that person. Obviously, stolen goods. I've seen this happen. We took a stupa that someone offered us, and later we found out that he was in Mongolia. He had, thinking that it was a noble thing to do, had stolen it from the Newark Museum to restore it to a Buddhist temple. And we were like in a spot, you know. Like, if you think it might hurt the person financially, you know, if it might get them into a financial bind, you're not allowed to take it. Yeah, it's not you don't break your vow if you don't take it, I should say. If you have any reason to believe that they have already dedicated it to some other temple or Dharma center, you know, something like that. It's already been dedicated to some other use. We have this too down in New Jersey, where they give it the same thing to three temples at the same time, and then it's like causes a big problem. Like they'll go around and give three different wills to three different temples, and after the person passes away, then there's always this big confusion. If you think any kind of problem could come out of your accepting it, and he gives the example of accepting a big sword, or and if you kept it in your house, people would. Or accepting a gun and keeping it in your house, and then it might cause a problem later. You know, somebody sees a gun in a monk's house, or someone is turned off by seeing a gun in a monk's house, or something like that. You don't break your vow if you refuse objects which would freak people out for you to own. So the next person gives you, like, certain kinds of cars and things like that.
Jimmy Jay.
Chuddhipala means to a person who wants the Dharma. To a person who wants the Dharma. Jinmi Jai means you don't give it to them. Any objections?
don't get what
sounds like one of the root vowels.
Yeah, good. Okay. Dr. Shimmer, Chunomikishin. It is the second root vowel. And you're going to see lots of these. So Jetsam Kapa, being Jetsam Kapa, spends a lot of time to tell you what's the difference between this one and the other one. And this is the difference he points out. What's the main klesha in the other one? When you don't give money, when you don't give material assistance or dharma in the second root vowel, what's the main motivation?
Selfishness.
It's attachment to the thing. You don't want to part with it. It's called sena, chakpa, attachment. That's a very, very nasty. You can sense how nasty that is. Not to grant dharma to someone because you're attached to it. In this case, it's any other motivation, other kinds of motivations, lesser motivations. You're lazy, you don't feel like it, things like that. You're jealous of someone. Other mental afflictions than just having this heavy attachment to it and not wanting to share it. Happens all the time. It's called fake you. There's a special word for it in Tibetan. But you know, you withhold some knowledge so that you always look like you know more. And if you're really teaching nice, you pour it out, you give everything you can, you get them to a very high state as much as you can, and then you send it to somebody better, you know? Really, if you really want them to grow, you just give, and then try to refer them to the next step. Exceptions are sickness, okay? If you're sick and you can't teach, you don't break your vow. If in very extraordinary circumstances, it would teach them a lesson. If it would help them turn to virtue from non-virtue. And here's an interesting list. These are problems with the student. He says, if it's the kind of student who's sitting there waiting for you to make a mistake, you know, if they just came to the class, you know, to be critical, you don't have to teach them. You do not break your vow if you don't teach a person who's come there mainly for the purpose of being critical of the teacher. Same with if they are just come to be disrespectful. They're not asking for it in the right way. If they're not sitting properly, actually everyone's sitting properly. If you happen to know that they could never catch it, okay? And if they come and ask you for, you know, the Prasangika's view on basis consciousness or something, and you know that if you spent all night they would never catch it, you don't require to teach it.
But
you have to ask three times for teacher lesson? Traditionally, yeah, you have to ask three times for dharma. It's another point, but it's not to do with this vow, but traditionally you have to ask the teacher three times. The teacher, the first two times, is supposed to say, I don't know anything. Anyway, if you know that they would freak out if you taught them the real thing, you know that it would be too much for you. Like Rinpoche has never taught any of us the 50 verses on Guru Yoga, you know, how to really act towards your Lama. He has never taught it. And he refuses to let us teach it. It's so heavy. You wouldn't believe it. You wouldn't be able to absorb it. Things like that. You just know the person would freak out. If they don't believe in what you're saying, you know, they're not really interested in what you're saying. And they don't have any real belief in it. If they're in the depths of some very, very bad wrong use, and you meet students like that, then you should have a custom of interviewing people. I mean, it's bad if you have a group of people and one of them, you know, has this problem, then it's difficult to teach the group. And then even if you teach them what's the right thing to do, you know they won't listen. You know they don't have any intention of following it. Then you do not break your vow if you don't teach them. If you think they might get a bad attitude that would make them even worse than before. Like, you know people that, like at work when they start squashing the bugs, and the guy is this kind of joker type, and you know if you tell him it's wrong to squash bugs, he's going to squash bugs all day in front of you just to see how you react. Then you're not allowed to teach them about squashing bugs. You don't break your vow. And you know people like that. And then if you know that they will take that teaching out and spread it to other people to whom it would be improper to teach that, let's say especially on emptiness or secret teachings, you know they fully intend to go advertise it and distribute it to people who who are not ready and not allowed to have those teachings. This is like when they come to you and ask you to work on a Kala Chakra book, which happened to me, and they say, will you help us translate this secret teaching so we can publish this and get famous? And you're like, no, that's not right. You know, you can't do that. But if you don't break your bodhisattva vows. We'll stop there. Why? Because the next, we're going to do 7 more. We'll do them before night. We'll finish on time. Probably finish on time. The next group are going to be against the second perfection, which is what? Morality. So take a nice break. Come back.
Certainly, but we have a new monk in Sutta. That's certain, okay? Chalnam means people with solid morality, people who have broken their morality. And Chal means got dirty or broken. Sutta Chalnam means someone who has messed up in their morality. Yawar Dor means to reject them, to ostracize them. Excuse me? Sutta means morality. And the examples that Jetsukapa gives, he gives very heavy examples. Someone who has committed the 5 misdeeds, killing your mother, killing your father, very heavy ones. Someone who has broken their root vows, of their bodhisattva vows. And what he's saying is, you can't just ignore them, you can't reject them, you have to reach out to them and try to help them. He says, people who have messed up in their morality, or monks, for example, who have broken their vows and lost their vows, you have to be kind to them, you have to try to help them, because they are, he says, they are in the worst position of anyone. If you're supposed to be helping suffering sentient beings, he says, the word he uses, they are residing in the cause of suffering. They have moved into the house of the cause of suffering. They are going to suffer because of what they did. So if anyone needs your pity and your help and your assistance and your attention, it would be people who have broken their vows. Doesn't mean that, obviously, that you should let it rub off on you or anything like that. You know, it's very, very bad. And in a Dharma center or in a monastery, there are times when you are required to cut that person off for the good of the whole. You know, there are times when you're required to do that. But this is not talking about those times.
No, does it matter if that person has remorse or not? Or
not particularly. They're going to suffer. The reason you're supposed to be nice to them is nothing more than they have done something very bad. They're going to suffer from it. If they're very evil, you're required to resist them. But that's another story. We're talking about, and you know the kind of people. They were monks. They thought it would be. They got interested in the family life. They gave up the vows. They made a big mistake, and now they're kind of almost pitiful, you know. And you know people like that. And they went after something that turned out to be nothing, and now nobody wants to talk to them. Nobody wants to see them. Nobody respects them anymore. And you're supposed to try to reach out to them. Be a bodhisattva. Yeah.
The reason that their karma is worse than the average being is because they may have started helping such beings, so the magnitude of their karma is
bigger. But it also talking about normal, like killing and stealing. It doesn't have to be someone who has broken. No, you're right. No, it doesn't have to be someone who has broken vows necessarily. Just anyone who's done any very bad deed, even if they never heard of vows, you have to reach out and help them. Don't cut yourself off from them and say, oh, you're dirty, I don't want to be around you, I'm not going to relate with you anymore. Things like that. Yeah. Yawar Dor is a very heavy word. It means to throw out like rubbish. It means to ignore, to ostracize, to cast away, you know, all those things.
But you're also supposed to avoid people who might have a malevolent influence on you.
There's a kind of, if a person is very evil, you're required to avoid them and not get close to them and be affected by them. You know? So this assumes that you're not going to be led astray by them, okay? This assumes that you're strong enough to be around that person and they're not going to bring you into the same trap they got into.
perhaps a kind of a hello, how are you, a polite thing that, you know, kind of go away.
No, even depending on how strong you are personally in your morality. That, you know, I can stare on drunkards all day because I'm just not interested in alcohol anymore. So it depends. You know, it depends on your own personal, and you have to judge your strength correctly or else you're really going to screw up. All right.
Let me see what else he says.
You want some nyemes? Everybody likes nyemes. Okay. If it's in order, in exceptional cases, if you are a great bodhisattva, high wisdom, in order to
teach them a
lesson. Shen mungbu samsung, which means if in getting close to this person, you would alienate many other people, you don't break your vow if you don't do it. You know? If somebody, you know, like there's lamas who have appeared to be drunkards and things like that. And if you got too close to them, a lot of people might mistake that for you approving of such behavior or something like that. Then you don't break your vow if you don't reach out and touch someone. You don't break your vow.
I just wanted to teach all those people a lesson.
In order to respect the code of the monks, okay, there are times when the code of monks and nuns requires us not to reach out to a monk who has lost his vows, and there are times when our code, which I can't tell you about, requires us to punish them in a certain way, as far as internal among monks how we relate to them. And so you don't break your vow if you're trying to uphold the monk's code or the nun's code by not relating to this person.
I thought the Buddhist talks about superstition.
We'll talk about it. We'll get there. No, not in every case. Not in this case, for example. Paro Vechir means in order to inspire faith in others. Okay? In order to inspire faith in others. Lobmiche. Lobmiche means not to follow the rules. And that needs a little explanation. What it means is there are certain rules, especially for monks. Let's say eating after noon. Okay? If I'm in Sri Lanka and I eat hard food after noon, it would cause a lot of people to lose faith in the institution of monks. It's not a lot. It's very strictly kept in that country. So if they saw a monk stuffing his face after 12 o'clock, they might lose their faith in the whole institution of monks. So as a bodhisattva monk, you're required to keep your monk's vows even more strictly than the Hinayana who made them monks. As a bodhisattva, you're required to follow them very, very strictly in order that other people don't lose their faith in that institution. Of a monastic life. That's. Well, it sounds like that, but I'm telling you what it really means. It means failing to follow the rules, which, if followed, inspire faith in other people. You see what I mean? And if you translate it wrong, you're in big trouble. He says mainly talking about monks, but as we all know, when you're talking about bodhisattva vows, the Pratimoksha vows, meaning the vows of normal vows of morality, apply to laymen also. It means your 10 vows. So if you as a lay person, not a monk, if you as a lay person, people know you're a Buddhist, and if you lie, if you obviously stand in front of people and lie, they'll lose faith in the whole idea of Buddhism. They'll say, yeah, Buddhists are just like everybody else. You know, they lie. They stand up and lie like everybody else. So then they start to say, well, Buddhism is the same as all the other crap where, you know, they say, okay, you gotta do this and that, but you just break it. When it comes down to it, you just act the same as everyone else, if it's in your interest. So So that would apply to a layman also. If you break the shared morality of, that we all have, which is the 10 non-virtues, and someone loses that, if you kept it, you know, if you got a reputation at work that all the Buddhists at our company never lied, that would be really, that's what Buddhism is supposed to be. You know, that's the way it's supposed to work. But you would hurt the other people's faith that you...
By the way, these are the morality, the Pratimoksha morality. The morality of not doing bad deeds. Which are, especially the ones which are, they protect the reputation of Buddhism. You see what I mean? By keeping them, you protect the reputation of Buddhism. In other words, in Tibetan it's called protecting other people's faith. What do you want to call it? I don't know what you want to call it.
That's good.
Is that okay? But you know what I mean. They would lose their faith in Buddhism if you started lying. So these are for protecting... Well, number 9 is specifically referring to those kinds of morality, either monastic or non-monastic, which tend to protect other people's faith in Buddhism when you keep them. All right? You'll see why I brought it up. We're going to get to it. Say, Semchen, Junma, Zawachung. Semchen means living beings, all living beings. Junla means for their benefit. Zawachung means not doing enough. And what it means is this. If you take all the rules that the Buddha made, we call them proscribed rules, as opposed to natural. What do you guess the difference is between proscribed and natural? Natural rules are like don't kill, don't steal, don't commit sexual misconduct. They're the same throughout the world. I mean, all societies, almost every society, has recognized that these are naturally harmful to people. Those we call natural bad deeds. Then there's called proscribed bad deeds, or bad deeds that are bad because there was a rule made against them. By whom?
The
Buddha. Why?
I actually got a realization.
Somebody during his time screwed up. And the Buddha found it necessary to make a rule. And it was always, and in the, when you study Vinaya, the Vinaya is thousands of pages long. When you get to the incident, it's called the incident. You know, there was an incident. Some monk got drunk and went out and hurt somebody. So, monks can't drink, and Buddhists can't drink. That's a proscribed rule. Buddha made it after he became enlightened. I mean, he said, at some point in his career, he said, you know what? Alcohol just causes trouble for everybody. I now make a rule that no one can drink alcohol. So that's the main kind of bad deed we're talking about when you're talking about protecting other people's faith. There are a lot of rules that the Buddha made that are mostly meant to protect other people's faith so that they won't lose faith in Buddhism. But then there's these other rules that he made in order to achieve Zawachung. Zawachung means not doing much. And he made a lot of rules for monks especially to keep them quiet. Keep them in the monastery. Keep them, he said, just meditate. Don't do a lot of different things. Restrict your activities. Zawachung means restrict your activities. Stay in a monastery. Stay in your cell. Meditate. Read books. Do your prayers. And that's it. And he made rules for monks. For example, a monk is not allowed to keep a certain length of cloth for more than 10 days unless he makes it into his robes. Not allowed to own a piece of cloth that he doesn't intend to make into a robe within 10 days. Okay? It's very interesting. And that was not made because it hurt other people. That rule was made to keep monks from getting busy. You see what I mean? That rule was made so that monks wouldn't start going out and trying to get all this cloth. And having to have a house to keep it in, and then having to protect it from other people and buy a lock for the house, and all these things that lead to possessions and all that stuff. It was meant to keep the monk's life simple. So he made a rule against keeping more than a yard of cloth for more than 10 days, unless you make it into a rope. As a bodhisattva, you're not allowed to restrict your activities. You break this bodhisattva vow. If you strictly follow in the way that Hinayana people follow those rules that the Buddha made to restrict your activities. In other words, if you're a bodhisattva,
you're going to go out and get warehouses of cloth and obtain them and give them to poor people. You're required to keep cloth more than 10 days. You're required to go try to find a lot of cloth, and you're required to give it to poor people. If you break your bodhisattva vow, if you're a stickler for your monk's vows and say, oh no, I'm a purist, I can't keep this cloth more than 10 days. On the 11th day, you just leave all those warehouses of cloth when you could send it to Biafra or something. You see what I mean?
But isn't that breaking the vow, though?
It's understanding what's meant by
it,
right?
You do not break your vow. The committed karmic path, you do not break a vow. We'll talk about it.
Back
about the alcohol,
there's
certain ceremonies
when
you taste it.
That is not alcohol.
What does that have to do with the attachment or lack of attachment in those two cases?
It's
just whiskey.
Making, yeah.
That's right.
So,
in other words, as a bodhisattva, you break your vows. If in trying to keep some more basic vows that restrict your activity, you're very dogmatic. And say, no, I'm a monk. I can't keep cloth more than 10 days. Even though you have an opportunity to get a bunch of boxes of cloth, keep them for 2 months, and send them over to India to help you. You're not allowed to follow, in the way that Hinayana people would follow, those vows which restrict your activities.
Sorry, you might prescribe.
Prescribe.
So you can't teach the dogma of strict prescribed
rules. In the way that Hinayana people would. If you have an opportunity, and he says, bodhisattvas who aren't very busy in the welfare of others are not pretty, he says. It's not attractive to have a bodhisattva who's just hanging around trying to restrict his activities or her activities. Okay, we got to move on, or we're going to get stuck. You're going to get stuck. So these vows, these rules, that keep other people having faith in Buddhism. You must keep them much, he says, 10,000 times more, 10 million times more strictly than a Hinayana practitioner. You must keep, a monk, a Mahayana monk, must keep these vows, and a Mahayana layperson must keep their 10 vows infinitely more strictly than a Hinayana person. But these vows, these rules, that were meant to restrict your activity, you break your vows if you stick to them the way that a Hinayana person would. A bodhisattva monk or layman is always holding a big party, a big feast. He's always trying to feed other people, take care of other people, out doing things for other people, and that's the whole difference in the outlook.
It's morality.
And because it could refer to any of the vows like that. For example, playing music or something like that. You know, if it would turn a lot of people on and bring them to the Dharma Center, go ahead. But we'll get to that. You can feel that we're getting into dangerous territory. Don't kid yourself. Careful with these vows. Classic mistakes made with these vows. People go over the line from, I have to make other people comfortable too. I would like to do this myself. Alright, say Ningxia.
Ningxia.
Chena.
Chena.
Migeme.
Migeme.
Ningxia.
Ningxia.
Chena.
Chena.
Migeme.
Migeme.
The most dangerous bodhisattva vow of them all. Jetsun Kapa says the most subtle and the most dangerous. And it's too bad that it's at the end of the class. It should be a separate class. Ningxia means out of compassion. Chena means if you break it. Nige me means there's no bad deed. It's not a bad deed. And this refers primarily to the seven natural bad deeds. The seven natural bad deeds. That's the first seven of the ten. What are they? I mean, quickly, you should be. Let's do a tundra. Killing, stealing, sexual misconduct in your body and then in your speech, lying. Divisive thought,
harshness,
and wasted time. Okay, idle sense. Those seven, if you don't break them, when an extraordinary circumstance presents itself, you break your vow. Now we've got to talk about that very carefully.
you just say you have to break them under extraordinary circumstances?
Yep. Now, I'll tell you the kind of bodhisattva that you have to be for this vow to apply to you. Okay? In other words, for everybody else, it's a nyeme. If you're not this kind of person, you don't have to worry about this vow. Okay? You can think about it, but you don't have to worry about breaking it. The following. And you should put down each of these parts. Okay? It's on your homework. It's also on your karmic conscience. Kalpa Dumar means for many trillions of years. Kalpa Dumar. Lam La Gomba. This person has perfected their practice of the path. That's A. Okay. B. Tabla Kepa. They have an extraordinary insight into when it's necessary to do something strange or unusual to help other people. Ningje Chembo Dangdemba. They must have Mahakaruna. They must possess that ultimate great compassion. Look on every person as if they were their own child who just fell into a huge barbecue pit. That's the definition, pretty much. Okay. I mean, they think that way about every other person. And then he says bodhisattva. But I don't believe it would be required to have full bodhisattva. He calls, all throughout it, he calls anybody with bodhisattva vows a bodhisattva, which is not technically true. Yeah, in other words, you have to be very, very, very advanced for this vow to apply to you. Then he gives more, but I'll just read it to you. You don't have to write it down. But he says, this person, after taking their bodhisattva vows, must have kept them perfectly. This person must cherish other people infinitely more than himself or herself. This person must have bodhicitta. You can write that down. Must have bodhicitta. That's very hard to get through. They must see that there's no other way than to commit the deed. There's no other possible route to go than to commit that deed. And then they're allowed to do it for the sake of others. The classic example, you probably know. By the way, and then he says after that, he says, but it's not allowed for all people who are Mahayana. So it's not enough to be a person who's had bodhisattva vows. You have to have all those other qualifications. The classic example is when the Buddha, before he became the Buddha, he was on a ship. He was the captain of the ship. There were 500 merchants in the ship. And there was a murderer in the ship. And he was able to read the person's mind. He knew the person was planning to murder all 500 people. So out of compassion, he murdered that person. He killed that person first because there was no other way. And he had already reached this high level. When Rinpoche teaches this subject, listen, okay? When Rinpoche teaches this subject, he says you're not allowed to do this unless you actually have the power to transfer the person's consciousness to a higher realm. Okay? And if you don't have that power, don't worry about this vow. Okay. What I'm saying is that you are not allowed to do it unless you're an extraordinary person. People hear this vow and they get in terrible. He mentions all the kinds of hells you can go to for misusing this vow. Okay.
To transform the person's consciousness to the murderer.
The person that you, in other words, this vow is saying that under certain conditions, which I've just listed, if you don't kill that person, you break your vow.
Strictly murder. That's all we're talking about, murder, not
no, all seven. All the first seven of the ten.
Sexual misconduct, lying,
yeah.
Stealing.
We'll get there.
I have to do any good for it.
Yeah.
Raping or something.
Very extraordinary cases. Okay, we'll get there. We'll discuss it in detail. Okay.
Sorry?
Yeah, so we have to. I don't want you to go home like that. You might. Okay, so those are the conditions that Rinpoche has often mentioned. You actually have to have this extraordinary supernatural power to grab that person's consciousness and send it to a heaven, something like that.
Is that just for killing or all of a sudden?
For killing. They have to have the karma for you to do it. True. They have to have a relationship with you that you are the stick by which they go. because they collected the karma from me to do it. How's that?
But then they could experience the results of that
with
some other...
Yeah. Okay. He gives as the example a Buddha murder. someone who has been killing many bodhisattvas and Hinayana arhats for a long time. And who is collecting incredible bad deeds. And you have this great compassion where you say, okay, maybe I'll go to hell for killing them, but at least they won't have to go to hell for killing many, many holy beings. That has to be, your motivation has to be totally compassionate.
Well, yeah. They have to go for the ones they already killed.
Yeah, that's the way he puts it. He calls it, Jetsun Kapa calls it, a perfection of exchanging yourself and others. You'd rather go to hell than have them go to hell. Something like that. It must be a totally virtuous state of mind. You cannot have any kind of hatred for the person. You have to love the person with all your heart when you do it. And then he says, and I like this question, he says, and if by so doing they lose their life, it is not only not a bad deed, but your good deed, your virtue increases to the sun. You know what I mean? He's like, you've just done a very excellent deed. You know, it's not only not a bad deed, but you've just done some incredibly virtuous.
If you're willing to exchange yourself for the other, i.e. you're willing to go to hell instead of that person. Now, if you were such a great bodhisattva, you should have been able to help that many more people, right? So if you're going to hell, you will be unable to help people.
They call it the basketball trip to hell. It means boing and you come right back up. Seriously, no joke. They call it the rubber ball trip to hell.
Okay.
But according to this, you wouldn't even go to hell. Because it's a big virtue. Yeah.
What about the case of like the war going on now, U.S. helping out to stop the war?
I don't like to get specific. You know, I think Rinpoche's approach has always been, you come to Dharma class, I'll give you the rules. But then individual cases, there has to be absolutely no other option. Totally no other option. You must be doing it out of pure love. Pure, totally unadulterated love for that person. Concern for their welfare. Stealing, I'll give them to you very quick. Stealing, it would be like someone who was... they give the example of an evil government, which is hurting all of the people. Stealing, they are hurting all the people of the country. And if you steal their authority from them, if you strip them of their authority, those people, you have not stolen. You've done a very good deed. Okay? It has to be out of compassion. He gives another example. Someone who has made it their career to steal things out of temples and monasteries. And you go and you steal it back. Then you don't commit. You not only don't commit a bad deed, you do a huge, great, big deed. Good deed. And he gives the example of someone who was a caretaker or a treasurer of a Dharma group or a monastery and who, what do you call it? Embezzled the money. If you figure out some way to steal it back, it's not a problem. And then he says the same words. He says, not only not a bad deed, but an incredible good deed. For sexual misconduct, Jetsun Kapa goes into a very long proof that a monk cannot do this one. Okay? A monk is not allowed to break the vow against sexual misconduct for any reason. It doesn't matter if they're a bodhisattva or whatever. Cannot do it. Okay, an ordained person cannot engage in sexual intercourse out of some compassion and reason. He says if the time comes and you're totally sure of what you're doing, you must give back your vows first. Because a monk cannot do that. So, can't do that. Then he gives examples of why, when it would ever be necessary. I couldn't understand the whole thing. But the words I understood were that has to somehow be life-threatening to the other person if you did not engage in intercourse with them. You have to somehow threaten their very life if you didn't do it.
An example of this perhaps would be like when monks and nuns were made to fornicate with the Chinese authorities or something like that.
Maybe something like that. And they said, we're going to kill her.
We're going to kill her.
So then the monk would have to give his, he'd mentally have to give his vows back. or do a ceremony doing stuff. Otherwise, better to let them kill you. Lying, he gives examples of people doing some horrible, horrible actions, hurting many people, and you're lying to get them out, to get them to stop. Divisive speech, he gives the example of a charlatan, a religious teacher who's a fake and hurting people, and you purposely create a schism in that group. You try to split the followers away from that evil teacher. Like this guy teaching the people that it's a holy practice to fornicate, you know, and that this will bring you, or there were other that if you steal for me, this is a good deed, you know, and you steal from other people and come and offer it to me, and this is a holy practice. If you do your best to lie or do whatever you have to do to split people from that person, you don't break it. You actually collect a good deal. If, by the way, if it's the last resort, if it's totally the only thing that you could do. Harsh words, obviously, if you have to correct someone with very, very evil language. If it's the last way you could ever get to get them to be good, you have to do it. And then about idle talk, useless talk, singing songs, dancing, playing music, things like that. If it's the only way you could ever find to get to attract these people into being Buddhist. He says you cannot commit the last three of the ten under any circumstances. Why not? Those are mental. You know, what are you going to do? Hate someone for the good of all sentient beings? You know? Okay? You're going to have a wrong view for the good of all sentient beings? You know? You're going to want someone else's possessions for the good of all sentient beings? I mean, the mental ones you cannot do for anything. Yeah.
Last thing you mentioned, idle talk, singing, dancing, and are we supposed to incorporate into idle...
He gives those examples. I mean, as a layman, you do not break your vows if you listen to music and like that. You have to be wise about how you use that. You know, if you waste your time, and if you waste time, that it hurts you. Anyway. Okay, number 12.
Before you go...
Oh, by the way, at the end he says, at the end, the very last thing he says about that is, if it's okay to do the natural bad deeds under extraordinary circumstances, no need to say the...
prescribed
bad deeds. The rule.
Why is that just to a bodhisattva? I mean, just in normal morality, if you can save most people would think that if you can save someone by lying, so there's a murderer coming after, where's Jenny Jones, and you...
It's also true.
But why is it just... So it's not just...
He says, suppose a person never took their bodhisattva vows. And would it be okay to lie if you're protecting them from a search party which is going to murder this person? You say, I never saw the person. You hid them in the closet, you come to the door when the police knock, and you say, when the militia comes, and you say, no, I didn't see anybody. You are supposed to do that even in normal conditions. But we're talking pretty heavy ones here. We're talking like killing, you know, things like that. I mean, it'd be very extraordinary. And we're also talking about not breaking your voice up enough.
Oh, right.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right, number 12. It's the only way we can cover all the vows. I would be a bad teacher if I let you leave here at the end of the course without all the vows. And I can't make it shorter than that. And so you just have to stick it out. Okay? We're almost done tonight. We got a few more to go tonight, and we'll finish within 5 or so minutes. Okay. Wrong livelihood. Wrong way to make a living. The first 5 come from Nagarjuna. I think they sort of sound like they're emphasizing monks. Okay. Flattery. If you've ever been a stone buyer, right, Mr. Kiley?
Mm-hmm.
Oh man, you look so good today, and that suit is a knockout, and I got some stones to show you, you know? And I remember some guy saying that, and I said, listen, if I lost this job tonight, and I saw you on the street tomorrow, you wouldn't even talk to me, right? Someone wants to sell you something, and they tell you how handsome you are, and you're like, yeah, right. Flattery. Okay, that's the wrong way to make a living. Second one.
kimchi. Oh, Laura, those kimchi broth tonight? Mmm, man.
I don't know if anybody's in bringing anything next week. Okay? That's wrong language. Not allowed to do that. On a path in India, you know. Probably in the garden. Like, could you give us $5,000 for our Dharma Center, you know? You know, like that. You know the thing.
I don't know how to film it. Harassment?
This means the person really doesn't want to give it to you, and you just keep needling them, bothering them, hassling them. You know, and it mostly, you can see that these mostly refer, Nagarjuna was a monk, he was mostly talking about the monk's relationship with their sponsors. You know, you can't go and twist their arm and you can't be a more than a little bit of a pest, okay? Can't really force them to do it. And the word in Tibetan is almost force. You know, you can't like blackmail them into giving a donation to a center or hassle them or threaten them or anything like that.
What's wrong
life with
the lay
person? I mean, we're getting there. These are obviously, you can apply them to your life. Right?
So these are regarding monks?
Well, what I'm saying is, all the examples in Tsongkhapa Gyatso, all the, you know, the whole taste of Nagarjuna's lines are, it sounds like he's mostly talking about, you know, the relationship between a monk and a monk's sponsor has to be very subtle. You have to be very careful. You know, you can't abuse that relationship. You need sponsors, and you're at their mercy. And he says many times, if you honestly need something, and you must go to a sponsor, that's not breaking the vow. You know, if you go to a sponsor and you say, look, we need this place in Connecticut, and we'll do good things with it, and we just frankly we need it, and we want it. You know, you're not breaking your vow. If you keep going to their house, waking them up at night, and, you know, or telling them how beautiful they are, you know, that's breaking your vow. Okay, even if they are. Okay, did I spell that right?
Yes.
Okay. Anyway, pretense means to fake being a very holy person in order to attract donations and things like that. You like in front of your sponsor, you're very upright and honorable. And then as soon as you get out of their sight, you go back to normal. Okay. Those are the five that Nagarjuna gives.
That's probably is not normal.
I'll give you a number six. This is by Bodhibhadra, one of Atisha's teachers. I count it as a number six. The first five, to me, seem to relate mostly to monks. Sixth one is the following, and Jetsongkhapa lists it, and it is any kind of harmful occupation, which means he gives the example of trading in alcohol, you know, running a liquor store, trading in weapons, trading in animals, you know, like where you're going to hurt the animal or eat the animal, okay, like a butcher. He gives the example of silk merchants. Why?
Silkworms.
You have to kill them, worms. He gives the example. These are ancient examples, okay? He gives the example of owning a mill, a grinding mill, where they throw in sesame seeds along with a lot of bugs, and it's your job to crush them, and things like that.
Mills in general?
Excuse me?
Is that
He's just giving examples where, I mean, obviously you have to apply it to modern times. Any occupation which would be harmful to sentient beings.
He had in mind any kind of mills, yeah?
He had in mind anything where a bug could get crushed. Mm. Okay, that's that. You know what they're talking about. By the way, he says if you're engaged in such an occupation and you're struggling to get out of it, I can think of it like prostitution in New York. You know, you're wrapped into it. Financially, you need it. You're doing it because you don't have any choice. You have kids to support or something. He says, as long as you're struggling against it, as long as you're fighting to get out of it, you don't break the vow. You can be engaged in it, but as long as you're fighting to try to get out of it, you don't break the vow. It's like the one about desire, right? You don't break the vow as long as you're putting up a good fight.
Just how wild is wild?
I mean, in America, but what it means is to act totally silly, and you know, Wayne's wild
days. Wayne's wild.
Yeah. What's that good? Something excellent day.
Bill and Ted's excellent adventure.
Yeah. I mean, just go out and act goofy, and you know when it is. It's when you're just totally off the wall all the time, and you can't be serious, and you're just being frivolous. I guess you could call it being frivolous. You know, you just. No one takes you seriously. You're just wasting time by being goofy. He says, Nyeme, I love this Nyeme. Right? Nyeme if you're struggling to stop, but you can't control yourself. As long as you're putting up a good fight. It has to be a sincere fight, okay? You can't be like, oh, I really wish I wasn't doing this. He says to stop another person's grief. You know, if another person is really down or depressed, you don't break your vow if you act goofy to bring them up. Okay, that's my good. if it would lead someone away from doing a bad deed, you know, like you just kind of distract them and get them to do something good. If it would make the people around you, you know, if it would just create a better environment, and then, you know, for leading people to something good. And if it would attract people to Buddhism that you have a pretty good guess would not otherwise come. People say that's why Chogyam Trungpa had all these parties. I mean, seriously, people say that. And many, I've heard it reported that many of his students would never have become Buddhists if he hadn't hooked them in with some wild parties and stuff. You know. So that would be an extraordinary case. I don't know what the motivation was, but I mean, those are possible.